Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today's episode is brought to you by Vivo Life. I am so excited to be partnering with Vivo Life for this series. They are the creators of my favorite health supplements, and they're also one of the most environmentally conscious companies I've come across. All of their products are 100% plant-based, they're certified carbon neutral, and they plant one tree for every single order they receive. They have also just launched 100% home compostable packaging across their product range. So when you've finished with one of their pouches, you can simply add it to your garden compost or your food waste collection. This means no more plastic scoops and bags of protein powder going to landfill. Vivo Life make all of their products in their renewable energy powered factory in Glastonbury here in the UK. Now, I'm always the first to say that a healthy diet is the most important thing, but sometimes the right supplements can fill in the gaps that our diets are missing. This is where Vivo Life's products are so helpful for me. I take their vitamin B12, vegan omega-3 and vegan vitamin D3 daily, as these are the key nutrients that can be hard to get when following a plant-based diet. The best thing of all of this is that I know Vivo Life's products are made with natural ingredients that I can trust. I also love the way their vitamins are in liquid form, which means I don't have to swallow a load of pills, and it means I can properly absorb them. So if you're looking for natural, healthy, plant-based supplements that taste amazing and help to protect the planet, then head over to vivolife.co.uk and use the discount code TALKINGTASTEBUDS to get 10% off your first purchase. Thanks very much to Vivo Life. Welcome back to Talking Taste Buds Season 6. I'm Venetia Lamanna, and in this series I chat to inspiring thinkers and leaders who encourage people like you and me to live a conscious and full life. Florence Colley Raja is the founder and director of Ethical Era and the creator of the 2030 Positive Planet Agenda. Florence came to the sustainability sphere via her public sector work, where she worked with the UK Parliament, European Parliament and local government for a decade. Prior to Ethical Era, Florence spent 5 years researching and testing sustainability concepts in fashion at a startup level, which led her to explore all factors relating to sustainability and climate change with a specialisation in fashion. Ethical Era serves to track sustainability-focused organisations and leaders, and to showcase that organisations and individuals can be a force for good. In this interview, we discuss politics and how to lobby the government to create the necessary system change. We also talk about the changing landscape in sustainable fashion and the difficulties we still face as consumers. There's a lot in this episode, and I'm so grateful to Florence for sharing so much of her experience and wisdom with us. She really is wonderful, and I'm just very grateful. So, without any further ado, here is the wonderful Florence Colley Raja on Talking Taste Buds. Florence, hello.
Hi.
Welcome to Talking Taste Buds.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. Let's start as we always do. What did you have for breakfast?
Oh, that's a good question. I tend to eat what I enjoy most, and what's sort of, I guess, I don't like to call food good or bad, but what is, I guess, a bit naughtier. So I do tend to have something sweet in the morning so then I can burn off the calories during the day. So I did have one of those big fat chocolate croissants, and then that's me done for a day.
I love that. I'm very impressed that you can limit the chocolate just to breakfast. So let's talk about you and your life and growing up and who you are and your family, and just tell us about you.
Of course. So I'm of mixed origin, and my mother is Russian-Ukrainian, and my father is West African from Liberia. Liberia has quite a unique history in that it's the Back to Africa slave movement that was set up for people to, you know, rediscover the roots and go back to Africa, in essence, to find their way back to their culture. The interesting part about Liberia is that even in the act of doing that and setting up such a unique state that was the first independent state in Africa. They did, in fact, displace the indigenous people when they did move back. So there is a little bit of a sort of controversial history around that. So I was actually born in Liberia, and I was there till the age of 3, but things got quite complex in terms of politics. There was a civil war there. So my mother sent me to live in Ukraine, in Kiev, with my grandmother. It's weird for me to call her grandmother. We say babushka in Russian, so she's always babushka to me. But yes, so at 3 years old, I was separated from my parents, and I was sent to live in Kiev at that point, which was still, you know, part of the Soviet Union. It was at the time also, I think, that was a very difficult decision for my mum to make in terms of sending me away from her, but also Kiev at that time. This was a couple of months after the Chernobyl spill as well. So it's I sort of look back at my the choices that my parents had to make as sort of very complicated ones in terms of, you know, finding a new life for themselves and for us and getting us to safety. And I was in Kiev from the age of 3 till about 8 with my babushka. And then subsequently, I joined my parents in the UK when they chose to come and set up base here and make their life here. And it was as crazy as them sitting down with a map and saying to themselves, you know, do we do the US? Do we go to Switzerland? Do we go to the UK? And it was almost in a somewhat controversial way, but it was where was the easiest to get to, and where they would be accepted the quickest for them to be able to set up family life and obviously reunite us. So at that time, they picked the UK because UK has such a wonderful culture of being so accepting of people who have chosen to make their life here. So I joined my parents here at the age of 8, and so I have this kind of wonderful mix of cultures covering the African continent. A very strong tie to Russia because Russian is, in a way, my first language, because I forgot English when I moved to the Soviet Union and I had to relearn English. And so I think in Russian also. So that's a big part of my life. And obviously, I've been brought up in the UK for the majority of my life, and I feel very British. And I was schooled in public schools, which makes me, I guess, even more British. And so it's this wonderful mix that then gives me this wonderful outlook as to still always being part of a broader world and never really just viewing my life as just me or my family and just the, you know, the city I'm in or the, you know, the country I'm in. I always feel very connected to all cultures around the world and in the sense of our responsibility to other people.
What an amazing, interesting start in life that you had. You obviously have all of these different influences. How did that affect the food that you were eating when you were little? What kind of food did you grow up on?
So we grew up with parents very much so cooking, and that's not to say that people don't cook in certain cultures, but I think that's more to do with time frames. People have started to eat, you know, ready meals and very processed foods, and I think those were more readily available in the West sooner relative to sort of, you know, the development and industrialization of the food industry, but specific to, I guess, African food, that hasn't happened so much. People really very much so cook from scratch, and it's really wonderful food. I hate to say it is quite meat heavy, and obviously that's not necessarily good for you know, the environment and the planet as a whole. Russian food it's interesting because it's also very much defined by the history of the Soviet Union and the fact that there was very little interaction with, you know, the outside world, and so we used what we had. So there's a lot of activities such as, you know, mushroom picking, and I don't know, we were very close to the land, and we have this concept in Russia because people, in the Soviet Union, people didn't really travel much. That wasn't allowed as such during the Soviet period, and prior to that, people, you know, before the Soviet Union, people didn't travel because, you know, transport wasn't as developed, you know, in the 19th century. So we have a concept of something called the dacha, which is like a summer holiday place where people go to spend time, and you always have land next to it. So we're very sort of, you know, hands-on. It's almost like the allotment concept, but taking it a step further. It's like a country home where you go to spend summers, and you go mushroom picking, and you have cherry trees and apple trees, and it's all part of, you know, the way that you see food and you use it, it ties sort of, you know, families together and the culture together. Now that I'm in the UK, I am a busy mum, we have different dietary requirements in my home, in that my son was born with very severe allergies. That has given me a different, I guess, slant on food as to, you know, the impact it can have on, you know, a body and how careful you have to be relative to allergies. But this made me more creative, perhaps, also in what we can do in our household relative to that. So it's sort of a mixed batch of African food, some Russian food, British food, I mean, wild food, Italian food. My husband's Indian, so he does like his spice. So there's a lot of Indian food, and that's something new, I guess, in my repertoire in the last 8 years that we've been married, is that I've actually learned to cook Indian food as well, which has been great fun.
I bet. That must be amazing. Yes. And you said that your parents decided to move to the UK because it had a reputation of being very welcoming. Was that your experience when you guys got here?
100%. I've always felt at home here. This is my home. I have never been questioned as to who I am, where I'm from. The UK has given me the best opportunities that perhaps would not have been available even in my own countries, especially as someone of mixed origin. I think sometimes in countries where there tends to be sort of, you know, one set culture, you would still sit on the periphery of that. Whereas I think in the UK, it's especially London, it's such an international set. People come here to work, people come here to settle. So I was educated in the private school system through scholarships. That was the most, you know, wonderful opportunities. Not because I necessarily would promote the concept of having that segregation of, you know, private schools and state schools. I think that's not necessarily a good thing, but it was a good thing for me at the time growing up relative to what the UK structure is and the opportunities it gave me then to subsequently go to, you know, fantastic universities when my parents didn't have that much money at that given point to offer us that. So I think, you know, things are changing somewhat relative to, I guess, the rise of, you know, these movements that are now starting to talk about immigration in a way that's perhaps a little bit unsavory to me. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit of confusion relative to the information that's being put out there for people. So through my politics work, I have campaigned, you know, all the way from here up to Scotland, Ireland, you know, the North and various different places. And I think a lot of people perhaps might point, you know, their finger or start speaking about immigration as perhaps the cause of some of the issues. But I think what the cause is that they've actually been forgotten outside of London. I think all investment, all the activities happen in London, and there hasn't been much investment in the rest of the UK. And people are looking for sort of a scapegoat relative to sort of, you know, who they want to point the finger at, that, you know, those opportunities aren't available to them, but they're not available to them not because of, you know, immigrants, etc. They're actually not available to them because, you know, there has been no investment into many of these places. If you go to the Isle of Wight, for instance, my mum's retired there, it's like stepping back into the 40s, 50s. You can tell that no money has been put into, you know, the island for many, many years. So you can understand, you know, how people feel perhaps. But no, I absolutely love the UK, and this is home, and this is definitely home for me for the foreseeable future. And I hope to be part of a movement of perhaps healing the country after, I think, some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years.
It feels like we are living in the most interesting time, and I am definitely no political specialist in any way. I'm trying to learn more, which is why partly I've got you here to learn more. But one of the things that seemed to come out of the election kind of backs up what you've just said, is how people who are outside of London have felt very kind of left alone, and that and I think the reason they said that the reason why the Conservatives did actually win is because they maybe put more effort in those areas and they tried to win those seats. But before we get there, can we talk a little bit about your career and how you got into politics, and if that was your intention to get into politics, and how that experience was for you?
I come from a family of artists. My mum is a piano teacher and a pianist in a former life. My father is a jazz trumpeter.
Wow.
but as we know, the arts doesn't really pay well, so they've had other jobs along the way. My mum has taught in schools. My father had, you know, jobs in IT and tech and in teaching as well. So they've always had multiple jobs to sort of, you know, keep their lives going. So my original plan was to be a ballet dancer, and alongside being at school, I trained as a ballet dancer my whole life. And at the age of 16, I joined a company called Ballet Black. That was a company to promote ethnic minority dancers because we don't have as many opportunities in the main companies. That has changed now. I joined the company when I was 16, called Ballet Black. I had a good run with them until the age of 21. Instead of having a job in a shop, I danced in the ballet company to, you know, fund my way through university, and it was fantastic. But then I hung up my pointe shoes. I didn't see any other opportunities. So I, at that point, made a very strange decision in that I thought, if I can't do what I love, I'm going to go and do that which can make the most money. And I think I felt that sense also in that necessity because at that given point my brother needed assistance to also get through university. My mum was divorced and needed some financial assistance, so I went after an investment banking job. I ended up working in investment banks after being an artist, which is, you know, the strangest thing. But I studied politics and economics at university, and so I ended up working on that asset management side of investment banks. Wow. In hedge funds and funded funds, private equity. It was really interesting. And I can't say I was brilliant at it. I worked hard. Internally, I think I struggled with it because you can't run away from who you are. And if you're an artist, you're an artist. And I think that jobs like that can be quite difficult. With the politics, that happened actually by accident. So I did some environmental campaigning in my local area, orientated around the green belt and saving a few spots from developers who were trying to get in a small community with very elderly people. And they were trying to bully people in terms of them selling off their properties to build these big developments. And I was sort of like, oh, this is not happening on my watch. I think 24, 25. And so we did this whole sort of local campaign to stop these developers getting in. And at that point, I was approached by the local councillors, and they were sort of like, well, why don't you get involved in local politics? And it sort of grew from there. While I was working, it seems like I've always had like a double life. While at university, I was a ballet dancer. While I was in investment banking, I suddenly had this double life, in the evenings, going out campaigning on local issues, and I was doing politics. And it kind of grew from there quite accidentally. I went from local politics to getting onto the UK parliamentary candidates list to run for UK parliament. I was shortlisted for European parliament. So it was really quite unusual because that wasn't planned. When the opportunity presented itself, relative to the countries that I came from, where, you know, you've got Liberia, where you've had the civil war and very few people would, you know, have a voice to speak up politically about something, or the Soviet Union, where the consequences of speaking up about something is very, you know, dire. I felt that there was no way that I could say no to an opportunity like that. So I kind of just went with it, and it just became bigger than I realized and almost took over my life in a good way, and in some ways maybe not in a good way either.
So you started getting involved with politics as a result of kind of caring about social justice issues. Mm-hmm. But I know you as someone who really passionately cares about environmental justice issues. Yes. So when did you start thinking about the planet in that way, and how did that come into your politics?
So I always thought about the planet, but I guess when you're in politics and you deal with environmental issues, in inverted commas, you're very much so dealing with your local areas, so your local ward or constituency, or you're just looking at the, you know, UK as a whole, and that's your job as, you know, an up-and-coming UK politician. It only dawned on me about the issue of sustainability only came to light and unraveled and sort of opened up to me when I left politics. That's the strangest thing. And that's what shocked me the most, is that I could be educated in the top university, work as a UK, you know, politician, prospective politician, and having worked in investment banks, and yet I never understood any of the information and how extreme it is, and the nature of how much obviously we are relying on our planet. And you know that at the light level, but how much damage we have done, in the sense that, you know, soon we're going to lose the resources that we have. So that only came about when I left politics post sort of 30 plus, and my son was born. And at that point, I had a difficult run in that I wasn't treated well after having children in politics, and I would be honest, I was pretty much pushed out of running for office. And at that point, my son was ill with these allergies that I spoke about earlier. So I took 2 years out. And in those 2 years out, as many women think, you know, the baby will sleep in the corner and I can get on with all these projects. And I thought, you know, let me get back to my creative roots. And I attempted to set up a sustainable fashion brand, which is much more complicated than I realized. And it's in delving into the depths of having your own company and trying to do something sustainably, because I knew it was to be done ethically, because I knew the humanitarian side of clothes and you know, women, children being used in the sweatshops. But what I didn't realize is the environmental side of the impact of textiles and everything that, you know, goes with the fashion industry. And over sort of, you know, 2 years, my eyes were opened extensively. And I think once you learn that for one sector, you ultimately can pick up that same model and apply it to really any sector. It doesn't matter if you're in finance sector, fashion, agriculture, the footprint is exactly the same, be it, you know, freshwater depletion, water pollution, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. You realize that this is the case for absolutely everything. And once you know this information, you can't unknow it. But as I say, I was very shocked that it took me, you know, time out of mainstream institutions and time by myself and being an entrepreneur and trying to do something ethically to really learn how bad industry and business is relative to, you know, humans around the world and our planet.
So spending this time, this 2 years mm-hmm. trying to set this sustainable brand up and learning about the industry, the fashion industry and everything else, were you then discouraged? Do you think, you know what, I can't do this sustainably, or I don't have this in me to do this in the way that I need to do it mm-hmm. to feel okay about it? Mm-hmm. How did things progress from there?
So things progressed to the point where I realized that I would have to go back to, I've sort of been going around in circles, I would have to go back to using my advocacy and my political voice again, because it's all very well having a brand, and I think very highly of designers, and I think they're actually leading the way far more so sometimes than people who are advocates, because they are quietly getting on with finding the answers, whereas advocates can sometimes speak a lot about things, but often, you know, you ask, you know, where is the actual action within that. So it's not to belittle sort of what designers are doing, but I realized that I wasn't trained as a designer, that wasn't necessarily my forte, even though, you know, I wasn't bad at it. But I realized that once I knew that information, I needed to do more of it, and that's where I started stepping back into using my political voice again, but this time not in the capacity of actually running for office or being involved with a specific party, but instead using it for the sustainability cause, be it sustainable fashion or other sectors as well, because obviously I know policy quite well and I know what governments need to do. I've been in the finance space, so I know what, you know, investment banks and the finance industry can do relative to, you know, divesting out of, you know, fossil fuels, investing into clean tech, etc., and many other elements that they need to be involved in. And then I knew this sort of, you know, fashion side inside out, so I had these kind of three bases covered: fashion, politics and finance. And once you know three, you almost can venture into so many. And even when you touch on one, you have no choice but to touch on many, because if you talk fashion, you know, fashion in terms of pop, you know, a huge chunk of the textiles is tied to agriculture. So suddenly you know a lot about agriculture. You start knowing a lot about deforestation or land management, because that all ties into the fashion industry. So I found myself having to become, you know, vocal about it on a bigger platform and using that sort of political voice for the climate action and sustainability movement.
And how have you seen the conversation around sustainability change over the past, I guess you've been doing this for 10 years now, mm-hmm. and how are you feeling about it in terms of politics and what our government are doing?
So what's changed is that everybody's aware of it now, whereas I guess 10 years ago, or even more than that, there were very few of us, especially tied specifically to sustainable fashion. So many people will speak about aviation, speak about, you know, the fossil fuel industry, dairy and meat industry, but very few realize, you know, the impact of fashion. And I remember touching upon it more so from the humanitarian perspective and trying to host, while I was still working in pure politics, trying to bring that subject into parliament and having, you know, some conferences around it, some panel speakers come in to speak about it. And at that point, I remember being taken aside by a mentor and then speaking to me quite sternly and saying, Florence, you're going to ruin your political career if you speak about, you know, too much about climate change and environmentalism, especially, you know, what's this fashion palaver tied to politics? How does that even make sense? No one really even understood the value, firstly, of the fashion industry and what it represents within our GDP in the UK. So people overlook the industry as a whole as something frivolous, when actually it's a big contributor to, you know, jobs in our economy, which is, you know, quite strange. Even the fishing industry has representation in parliament, and it's like a fraction of a size, and fashion has never had any representation in parliament at all. Subjects that I was picking because they were either controversial or people wouldn't take me seriously, whereas now those very, you know, institutions that perhaps would have, you know, laughed at the subject or not being interested in it are now, you know, driving it forward and are part of a conversation, be it UK Parliament or some of these big, you know, fashion companies. Everyone's finally on board, so you're not, you know, you don't feel like you're, you know, the outsider or, you know, that mad person speaking about something that no one else is interested in. And when I first started at that point, it was only Livia Firth of EcoAge who was around at that time, and there was the Ethical Fashion Forum, which is, I think they've converted to Common Objective and now, and they were the only guys around. So the other element is that it's all blown up and suddenly there's like thousands of people as part of our movement, whereas at that time I remember scrambling around for speakers and reaching out to EcoAge and Ethical Fashion Forum at that time, and I had to fly someone in, which is not good, from India to speak about a particular subject. It's a charity that works with women who make clothes, and I'm wearing one of their items now. It's called beautiful. She, which is self-help enterprise, and I was scrambling around looking for speakers. There were no speakers to even present to parliament on the subject, whereas now if I decide to hold the same conference, I mean, you know, you'd have, you know, thousands if not millions of people you could invite.
But it does seem, it still seems to me that although the government, you know, you can't read a newspaper without reading 15 stories about the climate change now, which is amazing, but it does seem that the government are less on board with fashion. Was it last year that they rejected all of the proposed, could you tell us about that?
Environmental Audit Committee, the EAC, initiated the review of an inquiry around fast fashion, and to actually understand what is the human and planetary cost relative to the fashion industry. The report was quite damning in terms of, you know, how horrendous it is, you know, be it tied to modern day slavery and human rights violations. And those are not just abroad, they're actually happening here in the UK as well, because we forget that we used to have a textile, a thriving, you know, manufacturing industry up north, and it still exists. It's not as big as it used to be because things have transferred to other countries. But in Leicester and Manchester, there is still production, and obviously, I don't, you know, like to name names, but you will find it in the report. So it's public knowledge, but, you know, Boohoo produced things within space of hours relative to trends in their factories in Leicester. So there have been violations around human rights, even on our, you know, in the UK. It's a shame because so many people contributed to this inquiry. We had,
it was,
the report's huge. University professors, your top consultants, you know, charities, NGOs. The report, I think, you know, was pretty conclusive as to what actions the government needs to take, enshrine many of these, you know, laws that will protect the planet and people in, you know, the policies. And the government rejected everything. So that inquiry happened in 2018, and then the government reviewed it and rejected every element of it in 2019, which I think left people really quite disheartened. And the sad part is, actually, I think the fashion industry is looking for regulation. So I don't know why they fear so much implementing something. You know, okay, yes, you might have backlash from some industries and some people, but at the same time, industry in a way is also looking for you know, guidance as to what they should be doing relative to climate action and sustainability. And then I think they wouldn't mind some input from the government about that.
Why do you think it was that they rejected all of it?
Quite honestly, I think there's a lack of understanding relative to, I mean, the report is very clear, but I think there's still this attitude that, you know, there are bigger problems and bigger fish to fry in terms of focus of politics, especially in this period where everything has been focused around Brexit. And I think there's a nervousness about, you know, implementing anything that's going to touch industry and push, especially in the time of Brexit, push industry out of perhaps the UK by implementing very specific, you know, regulation that might make companies look at doing things, you know, elsewhere.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello? Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. There was a poll at the end of last year around the time of the election that revealed that 71% of Britons consider the climate a more pressing issue than Brexit. And Boris has, I think today, appointed a new climate advisor, right?
Mark Kearney, yes.
Mark Kearney, who seems to have a good background in climate issues.
Yes, yes.
And they are focused on the UK being net zero by 2050. Extinction Rebellion and other activists want that to be changed to 2030. Where do you see politics going at the moment in terms of saving the planet?
So I was really excited about the election, the snap election we had in November. I really had hoped that there would be the election that was about climate change, and all the polls suggested it, but I didn't really see it reflected necessarily in people's voting. So I remember sitting there deciding in the ballot box between two parties at the given point, because I was trying to think, do I make a decision relative to London and the UK and our sort of financial future, or do I make a decision to vote in a way that's about our planet as a whole? And that there was kind of that even tug and pull in my own conscience, and I think many people probably felt that. And so I did vote the Green Party in the end, even though I've never stood for the Green Party. I have stood for a different party in the past, but I didn't see it reflected, I guess, in the voting. So that was a shame, because that was our big opportunity. But there's a lot of exciting things happening. We're hosting COP26 here this year. The thing that people didn't even realize, if we take it beyond the context of just the UK Parliament, this is almost the most important year in human history. So that decade that we have relative to the projections that the United Nations IPCC report states, those changes have to happen this year, or at worst case next year, in terms of building that strategy. So yes, we have perhaps a decade, but it has to start in 2020. So this is the most important I think conference that will be hosted this year, and it's very exciting that Mark Kearney has been appointed the advisor relative to the financial side of it for Boris Johnson, because he is actually very pro-reviewing climate action within the context of the whole world, but specific to the finance world. He's really pushed for it. Now that he's stepping down from Bank of England, he's actually taken up a role in the United Nations tied to sustainability. So I think he's really invested and truly believes in it. And it's wonderful that he's going to be part of advising Boris Johnson, because I think it's many people know that some people are skeptical about the evidence around climate change, and Boris Johnson has been open with that in the past. And he has appointed people into his cabinet that are skeptical about climate change. So I think it will be a good counterbalance. But he knows that he has to do something about it still. So it's exciting that he's willing, despite perhaps his own personal feelings about it, to still push for what the population is asking relative to the polls, what they're suggesting. So definitely more can happen in politics, but some things are happening.
Having had extensive experience in politics and knowing more about the ins and outs of how you implement a plan and how you make it happen, which is something that if I think about that, all I can see is grey. I have no idea. Apparently he's coming in March. Mm-hmm. So does that give them enough time to implement a really good plan? It seems like the financial side of it is going to be the biggest part for the government. Mm-hmm. Do you think this gives them enough time? And do you think we should feel optimistic about it?
I think we should feel optimistic in how many people have moved into our movement, and that we're no longer a fringe movement. So mainstream people in mainstream organizations such as the Bank of England, or Parliament itself, or like BlackRock recently also a couple of days ago announced that they're signing up to, it's called Climate Action 100 Plus, the CA 100 Plus, and they've been trying to keep out of that for quite a while. So some of the biggest mainstream mainstream institutions are finally on board with this and are no longer in denial relative to why they have to take action. I mean, the reasons for taking action are not just tied to, you know, a specific conscience or like an awakening they've had. The awakening is actually numbers, not necessarily, you know, a sense of care, which that's a very individual concept, I think, for institution as a whole. Institution is a little bit clinical. It can't care. What it cares about only is really numbers and how it impacts, you know, the company. And so the numbers are starting to show for themselves that it's actually a risk factor having, you know, investment in fossil fuels and relative to the way that the trends are happening in the world, and that those people who are not addressing climate action, there's going to be a financial consequence for that relative to, you know, the numbers. People are finally on board, and mainstream institutions are actually doing things about it. Is it happening fast enough? No. And that's why you would, you know, you have David Attenborough, I think he was in the newspaper a couple of days ago. You know, he seems to be amplifying his language, you know, step by step. I think, you know, he's been trying to be moderate for a while, then suddenly his language got a little bit more extreme. And then a couple of days ago, sort of like, this is, you know, we are at the crisis point now, and we need to make this decision. This is a life or death decision now. And he has the ability to do that relative to his platform. But the difficult part is when you're sitting, I guess, making these decisions and having these discussions in institutions. And for instance, I was with the London Assembly, who hold the Mayor of London accountable for sort of his work that he's doing relative to London. We're discussing extreme weather in the context of London and what the impact is going to be. When you're sitting in a room full of people, I think they don't want to be alarmist relative to sort of, you know, what needs to be done and how quickly it needs to be done. We're sort of trying to talk through, you know, bit by bit, and we'll sort of talk about flooding in this very clinical way of these are the numbers and these are the stats and this is the heat wave stats and what will happen to London. The problem is that when you're in meetings like that, everyone's trying to be calm and sort of stay calm and carry on, but then you walk out of that meeting and you just think, oh my God, we are in so much trouble if you really digest the information. So it just depends on the, I guess, on the individual person who's dealing with it, how much they are willing to feel. Some people are sort of sleepwalking through it. They know what the information is and they're sort of like, well, we just got to stay calm and we'll sort it out. But I walk out of those meetings feeling, you know, I just, you know, I'm effing and blinding my mind and I'm panicked. And what I now do on a personal level relative to the work that I started doing is after I have really intense meetings like that, which can be, you know, 3 hours of discussions about climate change and something really extreme of what's coming in the future, I go to an art gallery afterwards to calm myself down, because I need that balance in my life as well. Because when you're dealing with really extreme information, you can start, as you know, many people have started talking about climate change, anxiety, etc. But I'm still always really hopeful, so I'm not panicked, I'm not negative about it. I think we can turn it around, but you do start, you know, feeling that kind of, you know, panic in yourself about it.
And that really beautifully links actually to something that you said when we were on a panel together. We were talking about the, you know, boycotting fashion, and you were talking about how you think, you know, human instinct is to create, and how creation is so valuable, and you know, that's art and that's fashion, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So where do you stand on the issue of boycotting fashion? Do you think that is beneficial messaging from Extinction Rebellion, their boycott fashion, the arm of that group? What do you think?
So I think Extinction Rebellion are wonderful in the work that they do, even if I don't necessarily agree with perhaps everything that they say. So they definitely have a place in this movement as a whole, be it, you know, climate change, sustainability, environmentalism, whatever you want to call it. Behind the scenes in the government, we've been trying to force policymakers to declare climate emergency for many, many years. But by speaking so calmly about it, we never even achieved that, despite our platforms and our influence. Extinction Rebellion came along, you know, what year was it? Is it in 2018?
It was only 2018, yeah.
That they came about. And then by 2019 of May, the UK government declared a climate crisis relative to Extinction Rebellion's actions. I diverge and I agree with them in some ways. We definitely can't purchase our way out of this. We can't buy our way out of this, that's for sure. Let's just get more stuff and it's going to solve it. But I think what we need to acknowledge is the reality that if we are not here to create, then what are we here for? So it becomes a very philosophical question. Is that, can human beings really exist without creating things that makes stuff. So stuff is a kind of an awful word in some ways, but generally what people are attempting to do when they are creating stuff is usually, you know, they paint and they create like a painting, or they're designers and they create clothes, or someone is an entrepreneur and they're trying to have a business. Ultimately, I don't think the act in what a person is trying to do in industry is just for the sake of stuff. I don't think that was ever the starting point. But what we're talking about is that that model of us as human beings wanting to create and make things has actually overproduced, and especially relative to sort of, you know, the model of globalization and the model of efficiency and industrialization, and how we sort of, you know, expect companies to have this endless growth that it's kind of got out of hand. It's a really hard one to answer. Yes, we need to cap what we make for sure, but at the same time, I think what we need to do more so is focus on where's the innovation of, if we are going to make things, it's just to make sure, you know, that the impact on the, you know, planet and human beings is minimal, and that when we discard it, that it has a, you know, ability to go back into that sort of circular economy, or it's, you know, biodegradable, etc., and can disappear really quickly. So I think we need to look at answers of, if we do continue creating in volumes, how can we do that in a way that's really just sustainable instead of non-sustainable, because there are answers to that already.
One solution would be to create policy around it. So let's take a fast fashion brand as an example. We could create policy around the amount of product that they were making, and also we could set kind of, I guess, guidelines and boundaries on the materials that they should be using. Mm-hmm. However, if we were to do that, mm-hmm. could fast fashion still exist as we know it now?
Definitely not. So that label cannot continue in terms of fast fashion, because fast fashion is about obviously the volume that they're creating and how fast they're doing it. So there has to be an element of slowing down that no one has addressed at all. So Zara, for instance, have announced that they're transferring to sustainable textiles and to a sustainable model by 2025. But there was no language in, let's say, their announcement around, you know, the volume. So even if they are using sustainable textiles, their version of sustainable textiles might be, let's say, a recycled, you know, polyester, or they're going to use organic cotton. But if you're still continuing to produce on mass level, even if you're using organic cotton, just think how much, you know, land you need, how much fresh water you need to produce that organic cotton. So there's no, even organic cotton is not really that sustainable when you do it on a mass level. And this is the hard part, is that essentially what we're dealing with is overproduction, overconsumption. We're dealing with overpopulation as well, and then our addictions to overproduction and overconsumption relative to a large population. So policy is not enough relative to what needs to be achieved. Ultimately, there has to be a cultural shift overall, I think, in societies, where we start to reject the amount of things sort of, you know, pushed on us. But where I say we have to work with these sustainability with these fast fashion companies, before that cultural shift happens where people perhaps reject buying in that way, is that we can't completely separate ourselves and say we will have nothing to do with you. Let's say as a consumer, you can choose not to shop at Zara, but as an advocate, you don't get a choice to say that you're not going to work with Zara, because the issue is, we need money in sustainability, and we need money to find the answers, and we need the funding to fund the research and development of new textiles, because it's not a fashion revolution we need actually a textile revolution, and that's going to take a ton of money, and that money can only come from one place, and it is going to come from the fast fashion companies and your luxury companies, because they're the companies that are at scale and at large have that money to invest to reform the industry. So it's a really hard one, because on the personal level, how you interact with this brand is up to you, and of course you should make choices in the best way. On the professional level, unfortunately, I don't think we get to bypass these companies, because we need, you know, H&M Group, Zara to invest the money, because that money can't come from anywhere else. The government's not going to give you that money, and advocates and in climate change and sustainable fashion or any company don't have that scale, because these companies are dominant. So we really need to always pull them up. So it's not about compromising relative to our message about the things that they're doing, but we also have to be willing to sit at the table with them. So I think many people like Extinction Rebellion, I think that's my bugbear with them, is that they refuse to sit at the table with these companies to actually have a conversation with them, be it the British Fashion Council or, you know, your Zara itself or, you know, any of these companies. But we have to sit at the table with these people to reform them.
Yeah, I had a big conversation with my mum about that at the end of last year, and I was really struggling, because I was talking to a big brand, and I I didn't know whether I wanted to work with them, and I felt like they weren't 100% aligned with what I talk about. And my mum was like, if you work with them, you're in a position to actually make a difference and to actually encourage change. If you don't, you're not winning anything. So I think it's so true. On a personal level, we can choose to boycott fast fashion. Absolutely, we can make that decision with every aspect of our life, no matter what it is. But if you're listening and you're someone who does work at a fast fashion brand, you're in a position to be able to take these issues to the head office or to your manager, or to make sure that everyone's kind of aware of what's going on and to actually create change. But I'd love to know more about how you personally shop, maybe in terms of fashion.
I would say 50% of my wardrobe is vintage, and that began before I even got into sustainability. I have always had this kind of fetish for, you know, these finding treasures in shops, and especially really expensive, beautiful things that perhaps you would not necessarily be able to afford. Obviously, you get quite a random mix, so you do have to supplement that with your basics that kind of tie your wardrobe together. Naturally, in, you know, the last, you know, X amount of years that I've been in sustainability, I try and invest in as many key sustainable fashion pieces as possible. You know, and there are, you know, fantastic brands out there, and how many brands are out there now is just phenomenal.
It's crazy, yeah.
In terms of choice. And my bugbear with that is that the price point is really, really expensive for your average person. But when I say your average person, I also would put into that category even your, you know, top 5% earner of sort of middle class level, because at that point, if someone's paying private school fees for, you know, two kids, a mortgage, elderly parents, etc., I can promise you, you're not going to be shopping at Stella McCartney. The price point is the difficult part, and that's why I also say we have to reform the fast fashion companies, because if people can't afford, you know, sustainable fashion, then we need to bring sustainability into the companies where people are shopping at, because that's their price point. I have my fair share of non-sustainable fashion before I got involved in sustainability.
You and me both.
I'll be honest with you, because people really need to be honest about this. Once in a while, I still buy things that are non-sustainable if I really fall in love with it, and I will walk away, like, you know, four or five times, and then I'll come back and if I still want it. Because the point is, I know that I'm going to wear something for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, if it's of good quality, because some things obviously don't last that long. But that also comes from the mentality of, I guess, upbringing and not having as many things. And the hard part is you also end up buying things that are sort of semi-sustainable, in that you can, let's say, pick up something at Marks and Spencer that will be your responsibly sourced cotton, and because it's at the price point that you can afford, and let's say that's, you know, the jeans I'm wearing this moment are £25 from Marks and Spencer, responsibly sourced cotton. But I know that Marks and Spencer was on the environmental audit committee list of human rights violations. So I, even though the cotton was responsibly sourced, I don't know if this was actually made in a sweatshop, but I'm not going to go and spend £300 on sustainable jeans. But I'm going to wear these for the next, you know, I've had these for, let's say, 10 years now or something. It's a really hard one, because also working in sustainability, you'll get pulled up for things like these when you say it, or if people find out that you are buying these things. But this is the hard part. We're not trying to be perfect. What we're actually saying is that, as much as we are able to vote with our credit card and our money, the information, and not just the information, is, you know, hard to work out, because I do know how to work out how to buy the sustainable things, but it's how complex the world is that it would still push you to buy something that might not align with your ethics. There is still this kind of, you don't have 100% power over your own wardrobe, over your own life, essentially, in the context of that supply chain and how far it goes. And that's really hard to, you know, I think, balance.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why people feel really fearful when and kind of at a loss when they see, for example, they see a video that I've made, which is talking about how H&M isn't actually sustainable and it can't be sustainable. And then they're like, but what? They're telling me that they are. And this is, I have access to this. What do I do? Where do you expect me to go? And I think it's really, really hard for consumers. And I'm totally aware of my privilege as someone who doesn't have to shop at H&M, and I have time and money. And like, this is part of my job now, which is amazing. But I also really understand the feeling of, so what do I do? Because I've been there, and I still go there. I'll come across a sustainable brand and I'll think, be pretty sure that what they're doing is great. But then there's an argument against absolutely everything, and no brand is going to be 100% perfect, are they? It's kind of impossible, right? Unless you're making your own clothes, which would probably mean you're making what one piece a week or something. Yes, it's pretty impossible, right?
Well, here's an example for you. So I'm wearing something made by I wear a lot of artisan things, but when it comes to artisan fashion, so even though that's made, let's say, at grassroots level, and it's not mass produced, there's no large volumes, but you can't guarantee necessarily what the textile is. So I know that this garment that I'm wearing, which is, you know, a beautifully hand embroidered canter piece, and it's made in India. I know this is made by women who have been rescued from the slave trade and have been given jobs to, you know, help themselves out of, you know, a difficult situation. Well, not just a difficult situation, but a very tragic situation in life. But I don't know what this embroidery is on. Is it on, you know, natural cotton, organic cotton? I can't guarantee that. So there are these sort of loopholes to it. And then, for instance, my scarf that I have with me, it's a pashmina. And this is actually a real pashmina. So very few people realize that pashmina only comes from the pashmina goat, so anything else is an imitation of that. But many vegans will have an objection to pashmina because it comes from goat, even though I can guarantee you that this was made in the most ethical way. I know they're like shepherds, but they look after goats, who actually is in charge of this venture in Kashmir, and they've actually had to do conservation work around the pashmina goat to rescue it, because due to climate change, unusual snowfall, they nearly disappeared. When I've tried to push this, let's say, project to other people who I work with, sustainability advocates, they were up in arms that I would be associated with something that was, you know, tied to an animal, so you'll get in trouble with your vegan, etc. So it's really hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. That's one of the things that I have come up against a bit, just because I still wear old leather, and I think, I know a lot of vegans don't think I'm in a place to be able to call myself vegan because of that. I probably feel more comfortable when it comes to new clothing to wear sustainably, ethically sourced wool than I do, you know, a jumper that's made out of polyester.
Well, this is a problem with even recycled polyester, is that you are bringing that back into the cycle again. I know, obviously, that if it's not a mixed textile, you could separate it and use it again, time and time again. But then you've got to tackle the issue of that microplastic shedding, right, in your washing machine, because people, you know, obviously focus on the main plastic. But microplastic, you know, is predominantly from our, you know, consumer goods, be it sort of beauty products or polyester, nylon, acrylic, and all these synthetics. So when you're even the recycled version of that, it brings back the same issue time and time again, that you're going to get microplastic into the ocean, and now that's coming back at us. And in our, you know, London has the worst microplastic in its rainfall that's happening. It's found in our tap water, it's in our food. So the consequences, we don't know yet of what it is, because it's still in small volumes, but let that volume increase, I can't imagine it can be anything, you know, good about it. So it's a little bit hard. And I think also we need the mainstream institutions, be it sort of the government relative to regulation on all of sustainability, or be it sort of institutions like the British Fashion Council relative to fashion, big names, to come together and sit down and sort of define the categories or things to make things easier. And we need to start having categorization relative to clothes. If I walk into a shop, I can sort of, you know, scan through what that textile means for, you know, our planet. And of course, companies don't want to do that because it will highlight, you know, the good and bad.
What would be your advice to someone this year who really wants to make some changes? And, you know, obviously we've had the election, but for people who want to do something kind of politically, what are the best steps that they can take this year to actually make a difference?
Well, the biggest step you can take is to actually run for office in some capacity, and it's much easier than people realise. I mean, the journey isn't necessarily easy in terms of being in politics, but politics is actually open to everyone. I think people always assume that it's only a specific type of person and the doors are closed to them, and it's much easier to get into politics. And once you kind of show up to one meeting, you'll find yourself, you know, involved, and you'll sort of be promoted very easily. And I would love to see more women in politics, because I very much so think this is tied to the female agenda, that we actually need more women in leadership talking about this specific subject. And this is not obviously not the only subject that a female politician would cover, but you can run for local government as a councillor, you can run obviously at national level. There won't be an election for, you know, the next 3-4 years, but there is that opportunity to do so. You know, if you are not interested in running for office, write to your local government, write to your local MP about your concerns about the environment. And because what people don't realize is that as much as the power sits with these big, you know, individuals who have these positions, but they are elected by us as, you know, ward members, constituency members, and they are answerable to us as well as being answerable to Parliament. So when you write to them, they have to write back. And it's not even, you don't even have to be creative, because if the government isn't doing anything to change anything about the environmental issue, I don't think you owe it to them to even have to write, you know, really creative letters. You can send the same letter every 6 months to your MPs, just saying, what are you doing about the environment? Kind regards, XXS. 6 months later, what are you doing about the environment? Kind regards, XXS. Because they get really nervous when they start getting letters. People sign petitions and things like that. Letters are far more impactful if they come in huge volumes. So if more people wrote to their MPs and flexed their rights as constituency members, I think that would be a great thing. Not everyone's comfortable about attending marches. I'm always quite careful to say, you know, you have to, you know, join our movement and start campaigning with us. People are activists in different formats. Some people are activists via their work, be it sort of, you know, a fashion designer who's putting the ethics into their designs, and they might never show up to, you know, a climate change march, but they're doing it in their work. It could be an artist, you know, you can even be, you know, a dentist questioning, you know, what goes into that content of that filling.
That's my dentist as well, okay. I should say.
Okay, interesting. So, you know, there's different ways, but, you know, it doesn't have to be about walking around with a placard. You know, there's different ways to be an activist. But the most important thing I'd say is just don't look away. So many people are just simply, they're so uncomfortable and they're frozen into this inaction through fear, and they just look away because that's the easiest thing, and just get on with my life and, you know, bury your head in sand. Just don't look away. Be willing to, in 2020, to look at it face on and actually, allow that information to sink in and what it means. And then I think you will come to a conclusion what you need to do about it and how you can go about doing something in your life. And then the obvious things, you know, try and shop more sustainably by buying sustainable fashion brands, shopping vintage, secondhand shops, buying less, buying quality. I tried to become more plant-based as well. I still eat fish and meat here and there, but not at the volumes that I used to. I don't drive. I take public transport only. I've never driven, and I don't plan to. And I know it's just little changes, and just keep the pressure, I guess, on by not averting your gaze, because if everybody really sort of, you know, put their gaze on this and said, we acknowledge this and we're looking at you. And you being, you know, subjective, it's you, Parliament, you, Mr. Boris, you know, Johnson as our Prime Minister, you as institutions, we're watching what you're doing and that you're not doing enough for our environment. And they're going to feel that pressure if eyes are on them. It's when we look away that institutions will get away with not addressing this.
And we were looking away for far too long. Thank you. That was brilliant. Okay, so let's do some final questions to wrap up. What are your three kitchen essentials? These are three ingredients, so foods, that knowing you have them in your kitchen make you feel more relaxed about life.
I guess tea would be one. Chili. I just like hot food, so I add chili to everything. And chocolate. But that's not really an ingredient.
It counts.
Okay.
It's easily one of mine. How would you feel about doing a quick fire round?
Yes, let's do it.
Quick fire with Florence. Breakfast, lunch or dinner?
Dinner.
Tea or coffee?
Tea.
Lemons or limes?
Lemons.
Garlic or chili?
Chili.
Walking or running?
Walking.
Yoga or meditation?
Meditation.
Vintage shops or charity shops?
Charity shops.
Sustainable fashion brands or renting our clothes?
Renting our clothes.
Netflix or board games?
Netflix.
Chocolate or nut butter?
Chocolate.
Talking or taste buds?
Talking.
Lovely. Penultimate question. What feeds your soul?
Art and culture. Without a doubt, human beings need art and culture to elevate ourselves above that just survival point. Art and culture gives us, I think, hope. It gives us passion and purpose. And I'm not talking about, you know, art in the context of, you know, paintings in galleries. I mean it in the whole context of really what makes us as human beings and as creative beings. So as I mentioned earlier, I spend a lot of time in the art space as well. And without it, I just just, I don't think I'd be able to do any of my other work. It inspires me. It rejuvenates me when I'm exhausted. And it creates this, you know, deep, I think it's the most beautiful thing that human beings are capable of. And it gives me hope in humanity, essentially.
I love that. And finally, what is your death row dinner, starter, main, and dessert?
Well, I don't think it would be a sustainable dinner then, if it was death row. It would be something, maybe it might be a bit sustainable. I think it would be something that reminds me of my childhood. So borscht, which is a Russian soup with beetroot. I know that doesn't sound very exciting, but it's very healthy. Beetroot soup. But sometimes you can put meat into it, if you wish, for that sort of meaty stock. My main, I guess maybe I'll go for something with African food, which would be like a fish stew that we have, that's really delicious. And then for dessert, this is like jumping around the world, I think I'd probably go for creme brulee.
I love it. Great. Actually, creme brulee is quite a popular choice. Yeah. It's a good pudding. Thank you so much. This has been brilliant.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and thank you to my sponsors at Vivo Life for making it possible. If you enjoyed what you heard, please do share the episode link with your friends on your Instagram stories. You may know that I'm hosting my first ever all-day podcast event on Saturday the 21st of March, titled For the Future, to shine a light on incredible people doing brilliant work in the climate space. I'm delighted to say that the event sold out in just a few hours, but there is a small chance, and I'm teasing you here, that we're putting out a few more tickets live very soon, so do keep your eyes peeled on my Instagram story. And as always, I will leave a link to my Instagram in the show notes and links to my guests too. I'll be back with a brand new episode next week. In the meantime, if you're in the northern part of the hemisphere, I hope you're enjoying the longer days and a tiny bit of sunshine and some blossom on the trees that is peeking its head out at the moment. It's really making my eyes a little bit more heart-shaped emoji like. I'm really appreciating it. Bring on spring. I am not here for the winter. Anyway, I digress. Have a wonderful day wherever you are, and I'm sending you loads of love. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.